Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, Scandinavia. I hope you're doing well today. If you are new to the program, we do independent investigations into all the topics that we find to be interesting and important. We cover, many different areas, and we are dedicated to finding answers, no matter where they will lead. We hope that you will find the discussions engaging, challenging, and that they will make you think, as we very much enjoy going against the grain, the currents of the masses, and countering the established and sanctioned viewpoints of our times that, as you know, if you are a regular listener, is based on social engineering, subjugation, and subversion of all of humanity for purposes of control. So we examine what really is going on, and in that process we learn about a lot of sinister agendas, but also this sets us on our journey towards doing something about it. We have Dr. Ricardo Duchesne with us. He is a professor in the Department of Social Science at the University of New Brunswick, St. John, in Canada. He completed a Bachelor's of Arts in History at McGill University and Concordia University, Montreal. In 1987, he obtained a Master's of Arts at Concordia, where he wrote his thesis on the origins of the French Revolution, under the supervision of Georges Roudet, one of the founders of History from Below. In 1994, he was awarded a doctorate in the renowned multidisciplinary program of social and political thought at York University. His main fields of concentration were modern European history, political economy, and the philosophy of Hegel. He studied with one of the foremost Hegelian scholars in the English language, H.S. Harris, and with Thomas T. Sakin, a Japanese economist considered to be one of the most important theorists on the field of Marx's theory of value. His dissertation, All Contraries Confounded, Historical Materialism and the Transition to Capitalism Debate, was awarded the Doctoral Prize Award for Best Dissertation of the Year, Faculty of Arts, 1995. Also in 1995, he was appointed Assistant Professor in the Department of Social Sciences at the University of New Brunswick, where he has remained since. And Dr. Duchesne has published 31 articles and review essays. His publications include one book, 45 referred articles, one chapter, 13 encyclopedia entries, and 18 non-referred articles. We are going to talk about his book today, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization, a major work of 528 pages. And currently he's doing research on multiculturalism and the identity crisis of the West. Welcome, Ricardo. It's a great pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you for being here.
Yes, I'm very pleased to be interviewed by Red Eyes Radio.
Thank you. We have so much to discuss and so much of your research and work that I want to talk with you about. Of course, in the beginning here, you teach at the Department of Social Science at the University of New Brunswick, St. John in Canada. Maybe you could just give us a quick overview of how you got onto the topic of talking about the virtues of Western civilization and the erosion of it, really, now at a time when it's much more than a fad to talk about its sins, of course. You only have to go to any university and talk with any professor to get the cultural critic's view, the cultural Marxist view, and the revisionist historian's view, as you call them as well. So how did this begin for you, Ricardo?
Yes, it is a long story, because like almost every student and graduate student and eventually professor who goes through academia, you either are already a leftist or you become a leftist as you go through this education. So I was a leftist. I came out when I completed my PhD in 1995 as a leftist. There was one difference, however, and that was that I had been reading quite a bit about Western civilization, even from the very moment that I got into university in my first year. I was drawn by the seemingly unique experience of the West. At that time, I couldn't do it in a comparative way, but I was doing a little bit of African history, Latin American history. And one of the things that drew me about the West, it began with one course, I think the first or second year after high school. And the course was about modern Europe. And the first chapter was on the Renaissance and then the Reformation, the Age of Discovery, the formation of nation states, and other subjects like that. And what I saw there was that there was some kind of pattern, some meaningful development that attracted me. Whereas by contrast, when I read about Africa, there was a lot of chaos, and yes, they decolonized themselves, and there was a process of nation formation, but even those efforts ended up in tribal warfare. And at that time, I was a leftist, and the answer was to blame the West for this. But in the case of Latin America, it was a similar phenomenon, not as chaotic, but quite chaotic through the 19th century. Looking at Mexico, for example, I recall reading about all these rulers coming in and out, with only one or two that I could make any sense that they had done something for their nation, possibly Porfirio Diaz in the 19th century, and it was because he was influenced by Auguste Comte's positivism. But other than that, it was these people who were just coming in, taking as much wealth as they could and leaving the state in shambles, and eventually this culminated in the Mexican Revolution of the early 20th century. So that was in my mind. Another thing was that I was drawn by ideas. And when I read various Western intellectuals, both contemporary but in the past as well, I would read Plato a bit and other thinkers like Locke and Kant and Hegel, including Marx, and I could see that the ideas were coming out of Europe. So I think that stood in my mind, even as I went through all this leftist indoctrination and myself embraced it and wanted to be a good Marxist. and so I would say that that was in my mind, and eventually sort of started coming out when I realized that academic professors were really against the West. They didn't really appreciate the high culture of the West. I thought there was something wrong with that. And I guess that would be the general background of my interest in Western civilization.
Obviously, we'll get deeper into here why the West is unique, and we'll talk more about that from your perspective. But all this, of course, has to do with studies in critical social sciences or culture critics or revisionist historians. What would you say unite these people? Is it just, have they taken the ideas of Karl Marx and kind of latched on to some of the things that come out of the Frankfurt School, actually, in terms of bringing psychology and sexuality into the picture as well, and building on these ideas? Or how would you explain these kinds of fields that we get in most universities these days?
Yeah, it is a complicated phenomenon, because these ideas themselves come out of the West. They can be traced back to the West, at the same time that they are not altogether continuous with prior developments in the West. But, you know, a term that people are now using regularly is cultural Marxism. What they mean by that is that whereas economic Marxists felt that the way to transform capitalist societies was to take over the economy and turn it into a communist economy, and from that transformation, the culture would follow and it would be changed. But one of the things that cultural Marxists have done, and we can talk about how this cultural Marxist idea evolved from Antonio Gramsci and to the Frankfurt School, but essentially one of the things they did and realized was that it was important to change the culture of Western society, to redirect that culture in a direction that would undermine our belief in Christianity, would undermine our confidence in the history of Western civilization, would challenge Western patriarchy, the role that European men have played in history. But in other respects, it's not just cultural Marxism. There are some people that concentrate too much on that. I would say also that the dependency theory play a big role. I mean, if you ask many people today, or you start celebrating or talking about the achievements of the West, they would immediately say, well, the West obtained a lot of wealth and exploited Africa and Latin America, and that's why they became rich, and that's what accounts for Western uniqueness. So dependency theory play a big role in arguing that the West was no different other than in having developed a very efficient state mechanism of by which they exploited other areas of the world. And then, you know, feminism has its own history and its own momentum. There are other currents like deconstruction, Foucault, History from Below, and some other more specialized academic students. So all of these things converge, or if you like, all of these things have something in common, and that is that they failed these schools that Western culture had to be somehow radically changed and transformed for human beings to be fully liberated.
Definitely. I mean, this is a huge subject. I mean, you break it down in detail in your book, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization Studies in Critical Social Sciences. It's 500 plus pages. So we have a lot, of course, to dig into here, and we have to, restrict ourselves to how much we can bring into the picture at this discussion. But nonetheless, you devote a good portion of your book in the beginning to counter many of the claims that, that the West basically hasn't been unique, that everything has been borrowed from other cultures and whatnot. Is there a way that you can kind of break down some of these counter arguments for us, Ricardo, of what some of the classic examples are of how West, have used everyone else basically to achieve their goals? Because what's interesting in your work is that you point out the gleaming contradictions, of course, that the very rise to the field that criticizes Western culture today wouldn't have been possible without the existence of Western culture itself, right?
Yeah, that's one of the paradoxes, and we have to come to terms with it. On the one hand, you argue, or I argue, that the West is unique. On the other hand, these people that challenge Western uniqueness themselves come from a very unique culture that was accustomed to criticizing itself and interrogating its past achievement or past ways of thinking. So it isn't as if this is an external force or a group of individuals who came from the outside, but rather it is a group that came from within and then began a very slow march trying to discredit what the West had done, and then trying to find, in their estimation, another way to live a more just society, egalitarian order. So it is a very complicated phenomenon. In my case, my first interest in really defending the West, as I said before, I had this background appreciation of the West, but my first interest in defending the West was when I realized that there were a group of world historians who were really dedicating themselves to the argument that the West was not really unique, that we had got it all wrong, that the West really was one civilization among others, that world history had to be seen as a history in which the various parts of the world were connected, each influencing the other. Mesopotamia at one point was the area of the world that was ahead during the Bronze Age. Egypt was part of that. And then there was another area of the world, China, for a long time, the Islamic world as well, in the 8th, 9th, 10th. Some people take it all the way to the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries. And then the West came along later on. But even when they spoke about what the West did in the modern era, they argue, these world historians, you have to see Western achievements in a connected way. And so one of the things I did, this was in the late 1990s, I joined a discussion group, H-World, and there were quite a few prominent historians there, Andre Gunder Frank, who passed away later, Kenneth Pomeranz, Patrick Manning, others associated with Big History, and I engaged in a lot of debates with them. And at first, I would approach it like a kind of leftist, liberal person who's saying to them, come on, guys, you have to acknowledge that there was a scientific revolution in the West, that the Western world did engage in these navigations, discovering many areas of the world, that there was such a thing as a renaissance, and you cannot attribute this the rest of the world, even if there were connections. And as I engaged in these arguments, I realized that these people were really determined to undermine Western uniqueness, that this was a goal. And it wasn't as if they were completely rational and did not have any argument. They felt that China's achievements had been neglected or India's achievements had been neglected. And I sort of look at their arguments, the people who would argue that China had accomplished all kinds of technological things, and a popular version of that argument about China is Robert Temple's book, The Genius of China.
Yes, and
he's basing himself on the work of that famous British historian. His name now just escapes me. Needham, right, that's his name. And Needham has dedicated himself all his life, I mean, as an adult, practically trying to understand Chinese civilization and culture. And in his estimation of Needham, China had accomplished many things in the sciences, in technology, and so on. So there were some serious efforts along those lines that I took seriously and that needed, in my view, to be read and properly assessed. And there were others about India, about Japan, about the world economy. But I think when I did that in my book, if you look at it, you will see that I spent it addressing all the arguments.
Yes.
And claims that the revisionist historians make, I realized that Western uniqueness still stood out. And at the same time, I felt that even those who argue for Western uniqueness had not properly even understood that uniqueness. And we can talk about that later. But to your point, what prompted me or against whom I was reacting specifically, I would say it was this group of revisionist historians who were determined to say that we should view history in a connected way. We are members of the planet. We are all in this together. Because this is what they aim to as well. Like, it's not just an attempt to reinterpret the past, but it's also this idea that we human beings are creating a new world order in which we will be more and more interconnected. So we should have that kind of history. And more recently, I have come to realize that this is also connected to mass immigration to the Western world. You cannot have a classroom that is diverse and then teach them Western uniqueness. You have to teach them, that's how they see it, you have to teach them how it is that all the peoples of the earth, all ethnic groups in one way or another, have participated in the making of modernity, and the West was not that special.
Right.
So it's connected to that political issue as well.
Oh, definitely. And just that basic concept, and that humanitarianism, you know, ideals, the ideas of human rights, universalism, you know, all this, that is something that is unique to the West, right?
Yes, that's all unique to the West. The very idea that we belong to a common humanity is a Western idea. And so this is something that I still struggle with, because on the one hand, I want to argue that they are wrong to say that we're equally interconnected. And even now, I would say, no, I wasn't saying this already in the book, but I would say it now, I would also hesitate to say that we are members of a common humanity in the way in which these historians see it.
Right.
But yes, that idea is very specifically Western. The notion that we belong to a cosmopolitan world is already there during the Hellenistic age. Stoic Roman thinkers are sometimes saying statements along those lines. The Christians also begin to say that. And this evolves and in the Renaissance through the Age of Discovery as well. So this culminates in the 19th and 20th century with the Enlightenment, and today it's even taken to another level, because I don't think people in the Enlightenment, now as I think about this again, I don't think they were really thinking of a common humanity in the way cultural Marxists think of it. They were thinking of a common European cosmopolitan culture. I mean, if you read some of the works of Kant and many others, members of the Enlightenment, you'd be shocked, or at least by the standards of today, they sound very racist, and they did divide humanity into different groups and rank them accordingly. So it's very hard to project back on members of the Enlightenment the way we think of a common humanity. But still, this idea that we can talk of human beings in general, and that we should be more interconnected, it has deep Western roots.
Yep, exactly. And let's talk a little bit about the exploring aspect of it, and also then one of the components that you did mention, that you know, that there is this tendency to say that everything that is Western has been borrowed upon. But I think that you argue in your book as well that certainly there has been a certain adaptation of sort, which is unique to the West, but it has been a different idea as well of taking ideas and actually letting them into our own culture and then picking up on them, continuing them, developing them further, and maybe even to a point where they're basically are unrecognizable from their origins, right?
Yes. I mean, again, one of the other dilemmas about the West is that the West actually has been more connected to other civilizations than any other civilization. By comparison, China has been quite isolated, Sub-Saharan Africa even more isolated. And these connections are both historical and cultural and geographical. The West is located in an area of the world where there are a number of seas, the Mediterranean. Hegel called it the forum of world history, meaning that many cultures and languages sort of came together around the Mediterranean. Then you have the North Sea, the Atlantic Sea, the Baltic Sea, and there are other sub-seas within the Mediterranean. So, and the rivers too, there are multiple rivers instead of one single river like the Nile or the Yangtze River and the Wanghe River in China. You have multiple rivers interconnecting the whole peninsula of Europe. So the West has been very connected. And this is one of the things I challenge those who talk about world connections. I say, well, if you believe that connections are important, don't you have to ask yourself whether all the regions of the world have been equally connected to the same degree and in the same way throughout history? And they just don't have an answer for that, because the truth is that the New World wasn't that connected. The Australian continent was sort of far off there, not very well connected, and neither was Sub-Saharan Africa. And so then when you start thinking who was the most connected, well, it was the European world. And that then raises the question, did that have an effect on Europe? Did it made it different, more dynamic? And I would argue that it did play a role in making Europe more dynamic. Now, does that mean then that Europe borrow everything from the rest of the world, or that it did not contribute much, or that it was kind of part of a wider global network, and that you can never understand Europe outside that wider global network? Yes, I was talking about China, that Europeans had borrowed a number of technologies from the Chinese. The paper is one of them. And the point I was trying to make is that even though the Europeans borrow a number of technologies also from the Near East, they innovated on them. And then they invented their own technologies. And this is already the case in the Middle Ages. The mechanical clock is strictly a Western invention. Spectacles. There is also windmills and water mills. Now, there are precedents for this elsewhere, but they did tinker with them in a more effective way, because in Europe, there were many rivers, and using water technology became quite spread throughout the Middle Ages. And the way they harness horses and attach them to the heavy plow or heavy wheeled vehicle, these were quite unique. And so just because you are influenced or you borrow from other civilizations, it doesn't follow that you did not contribute these things on your own. And when you add these things up, you see that Europeans were quite original in this respect, and throughout the Middle Ages into the Renaissance. And by the time you get to the modern era, I mean, it's one invention after another. It's not longer borrowing, but it's actually they themselves inventing many new things. So this argument that because they were connected, therefore we cannot see them in isolation from the rest of the world is a false one, because you don't have to see them in isolation. You simply have to understand what they did that was uniquely theirs, even though they were connected to other areas of the world. And I mean, we're talking here about technology. We can add about many things the Italian did in regards to banking techniques, bookkeeping, and other things related to commerce. And they did this very early on through the Middle Ages as well. And then you take it all the way to the Age of Discovery, and it's no longer the Italians, but now the Spaniards, the Portuguese are coming in. The way the Portuguese rounded the peninsula of Africa was unprecedented. Nobody had done that in history. Nobody knew what was below. And it was done in an organized, methodical manner starting in the early 15th century. And it took them almost a century to finally reach the southern tip of Africa and then move into the Indian Ocean. And as they went doing this, they mapped the coast of Africa. They gave it names. And they moved into the Indian Ocean in a similar fashion. And people talk about the Chinese vessels of the early 15th century, Sheng He or Sheng Ho, his incredible navigational equipments and how large the ships were of the Chinese and so on. But really, there's a dramatic contrast in what drove the Portuguese and what drove the Chinese. The Chinese, as I say in the book, it was more of an attitude of traveling in a calm way, trying to show to other peoples, like, look at us, we have these incredible ships. And then they were curious about giraffes and other animals and exotic things in Chinese eyes that they saw in other lands. But they were not really driven in the way the Portuguese were. Now the Portuguese are seen in a bad light because people say, oh, these people were just greedy and they were very violent, and they move into the Indian Ocean and try to monopolize the trade, whereas the Chinese were more curious and more scientific. But that really is not true, because the Chinese were not scientific in their navigation. In fact, they didn't really even navigate any area of the Indian Ocean that you would consider was new or novel. Because the Indian Ocean had been navigated continuously by many peoples. And so the Chinese were navigating through waters that had been navigated before, whereas the Portuguese were going through areas that had never been explored before. And so there was something very different about what the Portuguese did and the way in which they mapped the area of Africa. That was very scientific. They may have been ruthless, but that's part of the West as well. There is an aggressive drive and individualism in the Western psychology that also accounts for its dynamism.
Well, exactly. I want to get into that more in terms of the question of origins, of like how where you pull this back to. But before we do that, let me ask you a couple other things. You have studied this for a long time. Now, how long did you work on the book?
About 10 years.
10 years. I mean, it's just an incredible amount of material and you know, data in the book. I mean, there are some people today that see that all the evils of the world is because of development, industrialism, basically everything that was spearheaded by the West. I don't know, fully understand the philosophy per se, but maybe they have a kind of a romanticized concept of, you know, the noble savage or something like that. But where do you think we would be today without the West?
You mean other areas of the world?
Yeah, exactly. If we were to exclude the West and the West achievements, if you will, where would we be today on the planet? Difficult question, I know.
It is one of those what-if questions. We could think of the 18th century and then ask ourselves, if there was no Western world, would we have seen an industrial revolution in other areas happening soon thereafter? And I was going to say no, but then I wanted to kind of explore that question more, and I sort of started hesitating because by then, by the 18th century, other areas of the world have already been influenced by the West. The Jesuits, for example, had gone into China and had brought the telescope there and had tried to teach them some of the latest techniques in mathematical calculations and other things that the Europeans knew about. So there was that kind of connection already. So it's difficult to say, to separate the rest of the world from the West. But I don't think there were any signs that one could seriously see as foreshadowing an industrial revolution in China or anywhere else in the 18th century. And if you go back earlier in time, say in the 17th century, there is no sign of modern science in China or Japan or India. Only in the West do you see this. So if we are focusing on modern science and modern industry, and we say, what would the world have been like without Europe? Well, I think we could safely say that in the 1900s, the world will still not have seen modern science and modern industry. But, you know, can you extend that to the 20th century, to the 21st century? It's something that, you know, it's hard to say.
Oh, definitely. But, yeah.
I distinguish Europe, as you know, not just because of its modern industry and science, but in many other ways. I think the West was unique in multiple ways. And these revisionist historians, including historians who address the uniqueness of the West, they have not done that. They are preoccupied too much with the Industrial Revolution and with modern science, and they leave out too many other things. If they look at the transatlantic trade and the colonization of the Americas, they are concentrating on these things insofar as they facilitated the subsequent Industrial Revolution, but they don't look at these things as unique phenomena in their own right, as indicating something unique and different of a Western civilization. Whereas I do that. I think that we need to pay attention at the discovery of the world. That term, that traditional term that historians used to use, is still valid. Human beings did not know that the world consisted of these large land masses, and there was this large land mass, the Americas, further to the west. And the people that were inhabiting the Americas, nowadays it is often said, oh, Europeans did not discover them. They were living there. They kind of knew who they were. Well, not really. They didn't know where they were located on the planet Earth because they had no sense of the geography of the planet. I mean, it was Europeans who gave human beings that sense of the complete geography of the planet and a sense of where we are located, each of us. And to me, this is incredibly important. Can you just imagine that we have no sense of how the land masses and the small lands of the planet are proportionally related to each other and what are their sizes?
Yeah.
I mean, by the mid-16th century, the whole geography of the planet has been mapped. And so there is a cartographic revolution associated with the transatlantic trade, which the revisionist historians simply ignore.
Yeah, I think a lot of scholars and university professors as well hold this kind of anti-Eurocentric view as a kind of a reaction to what has been in history and downplaying the importance because of, guilt and other things, something like that comes with that baggage, if you will. We could certainly get into that more later as well. But I did want to ask you a little bit more about the question of origins. You were talking basically about the aggressive drive. I mean, how can we get closer to understanding, I guess, the values, for the lack of a better term, of the Indo-Europeans? And how far back in history do you go to kind of get to the roots of this?
Well, yeah, that's something that happened late in my research. I had done research about the Industrial Revolution, the Scientific Revolution, the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, Rome, Ancient Greece. And then I simply asked myself, well, Why was ancient Greece different and unique? And this is something that people have tried to understand. And among the answers that people have offered is that the geography of ancient Greece generated many city-states, which then competed with each other, and that created a dynamic that sort of explains why Greece developed democracy and philosophy and mathematics and so on. But that to me was not an adequate answer. It's very difficult to get from that kind of dynamic, which can be quite destructive and divisive, and from that to start talking about the dialogues of Plato and Aristoteles and the pre-Socratics and all these people. So I felt there had to be something else. And the argument that it had to do with commerce also did not explain it, because there was commerce elsewhere in the world. And really, I mean, when you investigate this question, no one really has an answer why Greece was so, people call it the miracle of ancient Greece, but nobody really has an answer why so many things happening in Greece, because it's not just one thing. It's not just the invention of democracy or politics itself, because this is some way of really phrasing it. Instead of talking about democracy, what happens in Greece is that we get real politics, because politics is not restricted to an exclusive group surrounding some ruler, but it's something that takes place in an assembly, and a considerable percentage of the population within the city-state will gather in that assembly and debate and discuss issues and their real contending positions and so on. So that really is politics, and is something that is invented in ancient Greece. But Greece also is the one that produces a tragedy, that produces dialectical reasoning. You could even say comedy, something unique to the Greeks, and geometry, and other things are unique to them. Even in the invention of prose writing. Prose writing is sort of what I'm doing now. You try to reason through something, saying accordingly or therefore, but if. This is something that you see among the Greeks as well. So trying to understand these things is very difficult. And I felt that we had to go back in time. And as I did that, I landed in the world of the Indo-Europeans. I went back to the Mycenaeans. And from the Mycenaeans, I went further back to the Indo-Europeans. And I began to examine this whole question of where they came from, what kind of people they were. And there was a lot of political correctness there as well.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me is that the books on the Indo-Europeans are either in a section, the linguistic section in the library, or they're in another section that deals with racism regarding the Aryan controversy. So when I communicated with some experts, some Indo-European experts, and began to ask about them some questions, you could tell fair that they were all mostly into linguistics, that they felt comfortable with the questions I was asking about the aristocratic spirit of the Indo-Europeans, about their energy and dynamism and the way they expanded out of Ukraine, right into the Balkan region and then into the whole of Europe and into what is present-day Iran and then India. They didn't want to talk too much about this or only in linguistic terms. Why was that?
Why don't they want to discuss that?
Oh, because it means that you're reviving the idea of an Aryan people as a dynamic people that went on to conquer other people.
Right.
Yes, they don't want to talk in those terms. Even today, I mean, it's amazing, but there are some good Indo-European scholars. It happens to be the case that just as I was investigating this, David Anthony came out with his book, The Horse, The Wheel, and I forget the other words in the title of his book. It came out, I think, in 2007, if I recall. And before him, David Mallory had also written a book that was very good. And those two books and a few other articles I felt were the best. But even they avoided, any. Partly it wasn't just political correctness, is they approached these issues in a very materialistic way, in terms of their economic way of producing goods or lifestyle. They don't use, you see the word aristocratic being used often in their books, but they don't quite ask exactly why it is that it is so prominent, why it is that they have this heroic poetry. Why are individuals personalities? Because that's one of the arguments I make, is that personalities first emerge among in Europeans. You don't see them in other cultures. So they don't really ask those questions, even though it is implicit there. And partly it's because they don't know about other cultures or have not read or think this cannot just be unique to the Indo-Europeans. And it may be that they're just being careful. They are specialized experts, and that's a good thing. Whereas I'm more of a generalist and I sort of speculate more. So, I began to read the secondary works on the Indo-Europeans, and the conclusion that I came to is that the first step, if you like, in trying to understand Western uniqueness requires that you understand the Indo-Europeans and you understand the fact that they domesticated horses, they began to ride horses. There's a lot of debate about that, but I accepted the idea that sometime in the fourth millennium, they were riding horses. They also invented wheel vehicles, along with people in the Near East, but the domestication and riding of horses is unique to the Indo-Europeans. And then in the second millennium, they invented chariots. That was unique to them, although that technology spread quickly through the Near East. They also are associated with what is known as a secondary products revolution, which is a way of saying that, yes, we have an agrarian revolution early on, which means grain production and domestication of animals, but the secondary products revolution involves the exploitation of various products from right. animals and the utilization of animals in a more effective way in your lifestyle and economy. So not just riding horses, but attaching them to wheel vehicles and then sustaining yourself in a closer way from animal products, cheese, dairy products, meat, and all a few other things that I'm leaving out, but that's what the secondary products revolution means, and the Europeans were quite good in advancing this revolution. And then the issue of that they were aristocratic, and by that I mean that the Indo-Europeans from very early on were people that did not mind having a ruler, and they were rulers, but they also the members of the elite viewed themselves as equal to that ruler and did not want to act subservient. And so there was this aristocratic egalitarianism, the sense that you may be the ruler, but we are equal to you. And if we don't like you, we either take you out or follow someone else.
This right.
The war bands. Huh. So those were the kind of arguments I made.
And it also has quite a bit to do with the concept of what made a noble man, I guess, right? I mean, we can certainly get into the master-slave dialectic of Hegel here as well, but just this idea that it was a strive to stand out in history, immortality in the recognition of their deeds, right? The hero's journey and all that. This is something we find throughout tons of different literature. I think you even have quoting something out of Beowulf in your book as well, this idea that it was the greatest, a life without heroic deeds was the greatest grief kind of thing. So it's that's a different mentality there in a way. It's kind of also plays into individuality versus collectivism in a sense, right?
Yes. I mean, before I began to investigate the Indo-European question, I read the Iliad carefully, and right away it struck me that this is a story in which People are identified by their names. There are many characters in that book. There is a king, Agamemnon, and nevertheless, that king actually is challenged by Achilles, and he's not a despot by any means. And then there are many other characters who have personalities, who perform heroic deeds, and live in certain places, and have children with certain names. So when you look at other works from the non-Western world, you don't see people being identified in this way by their names. Subsequently, I learned that this kind of heroic poetry, they are already among the Indo-Europeans. I hesitate to use dates, but it's way earlier than the Iliad. In certain fragments that have been discovered, you see this poetry already. And then after the Iliad, you see it in the medieval era. You mentioned Beowulf, there is the Song of Roland, there is the Legends of Arthur and the Round Table, and the ones from Germany and Scandinavia. Which one is the German epic poetry? The
Poetic Edda?
Yes. And so this is something that runs through Western history, and they are these heroic figures, and they're aristocrats, and they're very daring, and they think the most important thing in life is to perform deeds and to be honor, you know, your family and be loyal and sort of be remembered and achieve immortality in history. And the only way you can achieve that is by doing things that other people will admire or have not done before. So to me, this is the beginnings of an individualism, the beginnings of individualism in the West. We think that individualism is a modern phenomenon, but it is not. And some people have traced back individualism. You know, Jacob Burckhardt is well known for saying that individualism was invented in the Renaissance, but then some historians came along and said, well, no, I see it already in the medieval era. And then I encountered another historian who traced it back earlier in the medieval era. There's a book called The Origins of European Individualism by Gurevich. So he traces it back to Beowulf and other writings of the medieval era. But I went even further back to the prehistoric Indo-Europeans, and I see it there. So yes, this is the other way in which the Indo-Europeans are very important to Western civilization and identity.
Well, indeed, we have so much to discuss here. We're going to get into a little bit more of the destruction of the West in the second hour and talking about how it's being transformed at this stage. We're going to take a break here in a little bit and then pick up after that. But why don't we talk a little bit more about where people can pick up copies of the book? I mean, it's published by Brill, I think it was in 2011, and the full title again is The Uniqueness of Western Civilization and Studies in Critical Social Sciences. I noticed as well, by the way, is the book not out of print? It was a kind of a high price on Amazon. Where is it available, Ricardo?
Yeah, when the book came out in hardcover, it was way overpriced. It was, I think it was $150-something.
Wow.
Yeah, so I mean, it was a bad start. And fortunately, I did get good reviews right away. And so people began to buy it. And then I managed to persuade Brill to come out with a soft cover, and they did. And the soft cover is less, but it's still high at around $60-something. So yes, that has been unfortunate, but I do think there are soft covers out there. And if you cannot get it through Amazon because they don't have any, you can always contact Brill directly and they will have them.
Okay, well, that's good. We're going to provide the website for Brill. Let's see if we can just find that right now. I think it is. Yeah, it's just brill.com, B-R-I-L-L.com, where you can do a search for the book. We'll have a link directed to the book from their website as well. But do you have any personal website, Ricardo, that you'd like to give out where people can read more about you or connect with you if they have that ability?
Yes, well, I don't have a website, but I have a profile at the university that I have built up myself. And if you Google my name, that is the first thing that will come up. So there you will find links to many recent articles and other interviews and things like that.
All right, very good. That's at the UNB.ca website, University of New Brunswick. We'll have that linked up as well there, Ricardo. So, all right, we'll take a short break here. Stay with us. Much more interesting ahead. So we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.